11. The Enchanted Castle. Yakonov had held his position of trust as chief engineer of the Special Technology Department of the MGB for several years now, during and since the war. He wore with dignity the insignia of an engineer colonel, silver epaulets with blue borders and three big stars, which his knowledge had earned him. His position was such that he could exercise general supervision from a distance, make an occasional erudite report to an audience of high office holders, indulge in an occasional clever and colourful conversation with some engineer over his finished model, and in general enjoy the reputation of an expert, bear no responsibility, and pick up a good few thousand roubles a month. It was a post in which Yakonov had graciously bestowed his eloquence on all the department's ingenious technical schemes in their infancy, stayed aloof from them in the days of growing pains and adolescent maladies, and honoured once again with his presence the pauper's funeral of a failure or the coronation of a hero with a crown of gold. Anton Nikolaevich was not young or self-confident enough to chase after the treacherous glitter of a golden star or the badge of a Stalin Prize winner, to snap up for himself every task set by the ministry or by the boss himself. Anton Nikolaevich was sufficiently advanced in years and experience to avoid such excitement, and the soaring exultation and plunges into despair inseparable from it. Clinging to these principles, he had survived without unpleasant incidents until January 1948. Then, that January, somebody had suggested to the father of the peoples of East and West the idea of creating a special secret telephone. Nobody who intercepted his telephone conversations would be able to understand them. He could sit in his country home at Kuntsevo and converse with Molotov in New York. The generalissimo's august finger, yellowed around the nail by nicotine, picked out the Marfino establishment, which had previously been concerned with developing walkie-talkie sets for the militia. The historic words spoken on the occasion were, "Why do I need these transmitters? To catch burglars?" He set a deadline, January the 1st, 1949. Then he thought a bit and added, "Well, all right. Make it May the 1st. The job was an extremely responsible one, and the schedule extraordinarily tight. After some thought, the ministry decided that Yakonov personally must bring Marfino up to snuff. He tried hard to prove that he was overloaded already and could not take on another commitment, but in vain. The head of his department, Fomo Gurjanovich Askolupov, had only to turn those green cat's eyes on him, and Yakonov remembered the blots on his record. He had been in prison for 6 years, and fell silent. That was almost 2 years ago, and the chief engineer's office in the ministry building had been unoccupied ever since. The chief engineer spent his days and nights at the far end of town in the former seminary building with the hexagonal tower over its redundant sanctuary. At first he quite enjoyed running things personally, wearily slamming the door of his personal pobieda, speeding to Marfino lulled by its purring engine, driving through the barbed wire festooned gates past a saluting sentry, walking with an entourage of majors and captains under the century-old limes of the Marfino cops. Yakonov's superiors had demanded nothing of him except plan after plan after plan, and socialist obligations. And the MGB's horn of plenty was inverted over the Marfino Institute. Equipment purchased from Britain and America, equipment captured from the Germans, homegrown convicts summoned from the camps, a technical library for 20,000 new acquisitions, the best security officers and archivists, the old bulls of the MGB herd, and finally prison guards with the finest Lubyanka education. The old building of the seminary had to be converted, and new buildings put up for the prison staff and for the experimental workshops. So when the yellow flowers on the limes sweetened the air, you could hear in the shade of those giants the sad voices of slow-moving German war prisoners in bedraggled grey-green tunics. These slothful fascists had no appetite for work after 4 years of post-war imprisonment. No Russian eye could bear to watch them unloading bricks from a truck. Each brick slowly passed from hand to hand, as carefully as if it were crystal, and gently stacked. While they were installing radiators under the windows and relaying rotten floors, the Germans sauntered through super-secret rooms, squinted sullenly at the labels on equipment, some in German, some in English. A German schoolboy could have guessed what sort of work these laboratories would be doing. All of which was dealt with in a report submitted by prisoner Rubin to the engineer colonel. He was right to do so, but security officers Shikin and Mushin, Shishkin-Mushkin in prison vernacular, did not find the report at all helpful. What were they supposed to do about it? Report their own oversight to their superiors? In any case, it was too late, because the prisoners of war had been repatriated, and those who had gone to West Germany could, if anyone was interested, report on the location of the Institute and of its individual laboratories. Yet when officers from other MGB directorates had business with the engineer colonel, he was not allowed to give them the address of his outfit, and rather than risk the least little chink in his curtain of secrecy, he would travel to the Lubyanka to talk to them. The Germans were dismissed and replaced by Zeks, just like those already in the Sharashka, except that their clothes were ragged and dirty and they were not given white bread. What could be heard under the limes now, in and out of season, was the steady buzz of healthy gulag obscenities, reminding the Zeks in the Sharashka of their unchanging motherland and their inescapable fate. Bricks flew from trucks like leaves in the wind, so that scarcely one reached the ground whole. Zeks, chanting, "One, two, and down she comes," tipped the plywood cover over the back of the truck and saved the guards' work by crawling under it themselves, merrily embraced the foully swearing wenches, and were carried away through the streets of Moscow back to their camp for the night. So in this enchanted castle, separated from the capital and its unwitting inhabitants by barbed wire and bullets, ghosts in black quilted jackets wrought fabulous changes. Muffino acquired piped water, sanitation, central heating, and neat flower beds. Meanwhile, the establishment so auspiciously founded grew and expanded. Another institute, already engaged in similar work, was merged with Muffino, arriving with its own desks, chairs, cabinets, loose-leaf files, apparatus that would be obsolete in a matter of months, not of years, and its own head, Engineer Major Reutmann, who had become Yakonov's deputy. Alas, the creator of the newly arrived institute, its inspirer and protector, Colonel Yakov Ivanovich Mamurin, head of special and secret communications in the Ministry of the Interior, an outstanding servant of the state, had met his end in tragic circumstances before all this. One day the leader of all progressive mankind, on the telephone to the Chinese province of Yunnan, had been annoyed by interference and crackling in the receiver. He called Beria and said in Georgian,
"Lavrenti, what sort of idiot is in charge of communications in your department? Remove him."
Mamurin was duly removed, but only as far as the Lubyanka. No one knew what to do with him next. The usual instructions were missing. Was he to be put on trial? If so, on what charge? And how long should his sentence be? If he had been an outsider, they could have slapped a quarter of a century on him and packed him off to Norilsk. But the big wheels of the MVD knew how true it was that where you go today, I may follow tomorrow, and held on to Mamurin until they felt sure that Stalin had forgotten him. So there was no investigation and no trial. He was simply relegated to his country home outside Moscow. One summer evening in 1948, a new Zek was delivered to the Muffino Sharashka. Everything about his arrival was unusual. He was brought in a passenger car, not in a prison car. He was escorted not by a common guard, but by the head of the prison's department of the MVD, and, to cap it all, his first supper was served under a buttercloth cover in the office of the prison governor. They heard the new arrival, Zeks are supposed to hear nothing but hear everything, say that he didn't want any sausage, and the head of the prison's department urging him to take nourishment. A Zek who had gone to the doctor for some medicine overheard this through a partition. After discussing this hair-raising news, the basic population of the Sharashka decided that the new arrival was nevertheless a prisoner and went to bed satisfied. Where the new man spent that first night is a question that historians of the Sharashka have not resolved. But one rather primitive Zek, a ham-fisted fitter, came face to face with the newcomer in the small hours on the wide marble porch, later out of bounds to prisoners.
"Hi there, pal.
he said, with a friendly punch in the chest. "Where have you come from? What did you get done for? Sit down, and let's have a smoke." But the new arrival shied away from the fitter in disgust, his pale, lemony face twisted in a grimace. The fitter looked hard at the pale eyes, the thinning fair hair on the balding skull, and said angrily, "The hell with you, then! Vermin! Like something out of a lab jar! You'll be locked up with the rest of us after lights out, and you'll sure as hell find your tongue then." But the creature out of a lab jar never was, in fact, shut up in the main prison. They found him a little third-floor room on the same hallway as the laboratories, and wedged into it a bed, a table, a cupboard, a flowering plant in a pot, and a hot plate, and tore down the cardboard blocking the barred window, which, however, looked out not on God's world but on a landing on the rear stairway. The stairway itself was on the northern side of the building, so that even in the daytime there was scarcely a glimmer of light in the privileged prisoner's cell. The bars could, of course, have been removed, but after some hesitation the prison staff decided to leave them there. They themselves did not understand this mysterious affair, and could not decide on the safest line to take. The newcomer was promptly christened the Man in the Iron Mask. For quite a time no one knew his name, nor could anyone talk to him. They saw him through the window, sitting dejectedly in his solitary cell, or wandering like a pale ghost under the lime trees, at times when ordinary Zacks were not allowed out. The Man in the Iron Mask was as sallow and emaciated as any goner, after 2 good years of processing by interrogation officers, but his foolhardy rejection of sausage made that scenario improbable. Much later, when the Man in the Iron Mask started turning up for work in Number 7, the Zeks learned from the free workers that he was, in fact, the very same Colonel Mamurin who had forbidden his subordinates in the communications department of the Ministry of the Interior to put their heels down when they walked along the corridor. If anyone failed to walk on tiptoe, he would rush out through his secretary's room in a fury, yelling, "Do you know whose office you're stamping past, you oaf? What's your name?" Much later, they learned the reason for Mamurin's sufferings. The world of free men had rejected him, and he was too fastidious to join the world of Zeks. At first, he read a great deal in his solitude. The Struggle for Peace, Knight of the Golden Star, Russia's Glorious Sons. Then the verses of Prokofiev and Gribachev. He underwent a miraculous transformation. He began writing verse himself. It is well known that poets are born of unhappiness and spiritual torment, and Mamurin's torments were more agonizing than those of any other prisoner. After 2 years inside, without examination or trial, the latest party directives were still his meat and drink, and the wise leader was still his god. Mamurin confided to Rubin that the really terrible thing was not prison food. His meals, incidentally, were prepared separately. Or separation from his family. He was, incidentally, driven home once a month to spend a night in his own apartment. Or the denial of primitive animal needs. No, it grieved him to think that he had forfeited the trust of Yosef Vissarionovich. It hurt to feel himself no longer a colonel, but cashiered and dishonored. That was what made imprisonment so much harder to bear for communists like themselves than for the unprincipled scum around them. Rubin was indeed a communist, but after receiving the confidences of his would-be kindred spirit and reading his verses, Rubin recoiled from this happy find and began avoiding Mamurin, hiding from him, in fact, spending his time among people who unfairly attacked him but were his equals in misfortune. Mamurin was nagged by an ambition as importunate as toothache, to vindicate himself in the eyes of the party and the government. Alas, what this director of communications knew about communications went no further than the handling of a telephone receiver. Strictly speaking, he was not capable of work, but only of management. But as manager of an operation patently doomed to failure, he would hardly return to favor with the communication engineer's best friend. He must manage something assured of success. By then, 2 such promising projects had taken shape in the Marfino Institute, the Scrambler and Number 7. People either take to each other or line up against each other at first sight, obeying some impulse that defies logic. Yakonov and his deputy, Reutmann, had not taken to each other. Month by month, they found each other more and more insufferable. Harnessed as they were to the same chariot by some heavier hand, they could not break free. All they could do was pull in opposite directions. When work on the secret telephone reached a stage at which alternative experimental programs were possible, Reitman conscripted everyone he could get for the acoustics laboratory to work on the vocoder. The name was derived from the English voice coder. An attempt was made to substitute a Russian name meaning artificial speech apparatus, but it had not caught on. Yakonov's riposte was to denude all the other groups. The cleverest engineers and the finest imported equipment were concentrated in Number 7. Other projects wilted and died in the unequal struggle. Mamurin had chosen Number 7 for two reasons. For one thing, he could not subordinate himself to his own former subordinate, Reutemann. And for another, the ministry too thought it was just as well that Yakonov, a non-party man with a past, should have an unsleeping, fiery eye at his back. From that day on, Yakonov could please himself whether or not he spent the night in the Institute. The cashiered MVD colonel, suppressing his poetic passion for the sake of his country's technical progress, the lonely prisoner with the feverish pale eyes and the hideously sunken cheeks renouncing food and sleep, burning himself out like a candle, kept Number 7 on a 15-hour day and remained at his post till 2 a.m. Such a conveniently long working day was possible only in Number 7, for there was no need for free employees to work nights in order to supervise Mamurin. It was to Number 7 that Yakonov had gone when he left Verenyev and Nerzhin together in his office.